If you want to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 13 this morning. And I promise I'm not going to get into the whole thing about David where you're at, because that's a lot of times we'll be reading in the same places that you're preaching out of sometimes. And so it kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, kind of goes along with. This ain't one of those times. This is one of those deals where this verse is just kind of goes along with my starting at point. This has been something I've been thinking about for a long time. You've heard me talking about it here in the last month or so about what I want to talk about this month. I've been trying to devote more time and more thought into Sunday school and what it's supposed to be. I mean, it's not, I don't want it to just be, okay, today we heard two sermons instead of just one. And that's what Sunday school winds up being. I mean, there's a reason why it's a little bit different setting and everything, but it's to, you know, there ought to be more thought on my part put into it for the whole thing instead of it just being a Bible story or something, you know. And this thought, it's just been kind of rolling around in my head for a long time. And it's an interesting subject, real interesting subject. And it's so paralleled with our lives, both physically and spiritually, in so many ways. You know, we talk about this sometimes about how that, God is the creator and he made men in his likeness and in his image. And so one of the characteristics of God that's in most people, whether they hate him or whether they love him, they can't deny it, is that they have creativity. They have a desire to make something, to create something, whether it's music, or whether it's something beautiful, or whether it's a big structure, a house, or whether it's a, you know, whatever it is, there's this drive inside mankind to create, to make things. You know, I never really gave it a whole lot of thought until I started doing what I do, carving and stuff. And it, you know, sometimes it really does, you know, it speaks to me, and I'm not trying to sound, you know, weird about it or nothing. But sometimes when I'm making something, I think about how God must have felt when he formed Adam out of the dust of the earth. And he looked around at the people that was with him and he said, "Let us form man in our likeness, in our image. Let's make somebody like us." And see, in the beginning, that's how God originally intended for it to be, for us to be a whole lot more like him than the way we went. And, you know, I sit and think about that with these things I make, and I make jokes about them, all these little bears and different just stuff I make to sell. And the kids, the girls, they like my little bears. I'll make a big old bench full of little bears. And they're like, "Oh, look, they're so cute, man." And I said, "Yep, I'm going to take my children and go sell them all this weekend. You know, that's the plan, to sell all my children." And it's a joke, but at the same time, that I made that. I made that little thing, you know, and, you know, I get accused a lot of being a really sentimental, hang on to every little thing kind of person in a lot of ways. And so that's not a real good business to be in the sense, if you're a real sentimental person, because then you'd want to keep everything and that don't get the bills paid. But that being said, I don't know, you know, the part of creating something like that, and it's in us all. And there's a lot of things that the Lord compares, like certain trades, if you will, in the Bible. He talks about a potter a lot, and how a potter takes the comparison is that he's the potter, we're the clay, and the potter does things with the clay, and the clay just yields to his hand and all this stuff. But even in pottery, if you've ever talked to a potter very much, anybody ever been around a potter very much, but I haven't had the opportunity to be around one a whole lot. But if you talk to them about the process that you go through in order to get that material where it's actually able to be worked with, whether it's clay, whether it's leather, whether it's a chunk of wood, whether it's steel, iron, the process to get it to the point where it's able to be done something with is long and arduous. You know, people see, they'll ask me at a festival, how long did it take you to make that? And I say, well, 2 days ago, that fish was a piece of a log. You're kidding me. Well, no, I'm not kidding. But you don't understand. You know, someone had to cut that tree down. And then they had to take all the limbs off of it and get it up off the ground and let it dry for a period of time so to keep the bugs out of it, so the bark would, you know, and then get the bark off of it and then get it loaded and haul it somewhere and figure out how to unload it and then take a saw and take it all apart and figure out how big to make the piece. And then by the time that piece is sitting on my bench to be carved, there has been an exhausting amount of work that's went into just getting it to that point. And then I'm always one cut away from it being a disaster. Now think about our lives and how it's that way in so many ways with our kids, with our marriages, with our church, even our relationship with God. Because see, God is the one that don't make any mistakes in these things. We're the ones who do that. We're the ones that are always one screw up away, one bad choice away from fellowship being broken, whether it's between our spouse, our kids, God, our church, our pastor, our boss. You know, it's just that way. And I think about this stuff a lot. And it's one thing to have these thoughts and they're just all kind of rolling around like a bunch of marbles in a big cardboard box in the back of a pickup. But to take and line them all out and put them together, I've been working on this for a while. And it's still, it's congealing as we go along. But the Lord's helped me a little bit here this morning. So what I want to talk about, and you're always looking for a title, and this is what it is your name Smith? Is your name Smith? My name's not Smith, my name's Miller. And you're a Loman. And that's our name, see. But what I'm talking about is just a little bit of a play on words, but in 1 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 19 is the verse I'm going to read. Talking about, this is after Saul has been anointed the king, and you know he's made a bunch of gaffes so far and been pretty disobedient to the wishes that the Lord has expressed through his prophet to him about how to conduct himself as king. And they're to this point here, and you know, the Philistines, see, what you fail to realize is while Saul was the king of Israel, they were being oppressed by other nations at this time. So he was the king, but that don't mean they were free. No. Philistines was putting a hurting on them, boy. I mean, they were hard on them. Remember, this is all leading up to David and Goliath. So the Philistines had really altered life for the Israelites in Israel and Judea. Verse 19 says, now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. So that lets you, not making a joke, but there, you know, there was no smiths. Well, what's it talking about? What's it talking about? Blacksmiths. Men who worked with iron. Because that's what it says. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. So they went through and they took away all the men that knew how to make weapons. Now that's a rabbit hole we could go down about where we're at in our country now. We're not going to do that. But that's the first line of defense that the Philistines removed for their benefit from their enemy, was to take away all the men who were smiths. And you hear somebody, you know, it's funny because I talked to a man this week and he called me from up north of Salem, Missouri, and he has a stump in his yard and he wanted to know if I could come and do something in it or whatever. And he said, how much would it cost? And I gave him a price, and there was like a 8-second pause of dead silence on the phone. And he said, well, I can actually handle a saw pretty good. Is there, do you use some kind of template or something to make these things? And then so. And I just kind of, and I hear this a lot, and look, I'm not prideful about what I do, and I really am not, I really ain't, because I don't know where it came from, and I feel like it could just go away as quick as it came. But so I try to be patient with people, because I hear this a lot, you know, people, well, I think I try to encourage people, you ought to try it, go for it. I mean, at the worst, he's just going to destroy the stump that's in his yard, and it's just a stump. You know, at the worst, though, it's like I told him, if you don't have the right tools and stuff, you could hurt yourself. You know, it's not like cutting firewood. I mean, if you can handle, he was an older fella, and he's like, you know, well, I can handle a saw pretty good. And I said, well, it's not like cutting firewood, you know. And I hear a lot of people that claim that they are artistic, or that, if you ever heard somebody say, "Oh, my daughter can sing. She sings so pretty." Kind of like the mayor of Mayberry. Remember that episode where she was going to sing in the contest and sing for the people that came and visited, and it was really bad. Yeah. He thought she could sing like a bird, though. A lot of people will say, "I know how to do that," or "I can do this," or they'll claim to be, you know. But then when it comes right down to it, they don't really know the first thing about being a carver or a singer or a smith, a blacksmith. There's a, you know, Zach, you know, he went to horseshoeing school back years ago, and most of what they taught them at shoeing school was blacksmithing. Because, yeah, you got to know how to nail a shoe on a horse's hoof and not put a nail in the quick and not dig his frog out too much in his foot to make him sore. But there's a pretty good margin of error in that area. I mean, it's pretty easy to learn how to do that. The hard part's learning how to make that shoe fit his foot where it don't hurt him. And it's all about blacksmithing. And there's just a lifetime of knowledge that there is to be acquired concerning that trade. It's a really old trade. I mean, way back, who was the first one that they talked about? Was it in the old, way back in the Old Testament, there was a worker with bronze. Was it Nimrod? Was a worker with bronze and stuff like that. Ain't that right? But I mean, it was like one of the first mentions in the Bible of someone who worked with metal that way. And, you know, he was an artificer of brass and bronze and things like that. He made things out of metal. Well, have you ever tried to make anything out of metal? Now, obviously nowadays we got electricity and we got acetylene torches and we got plasma cutters and all these things to MIG weld and TIG weld and stick weld and wire weld and do all this stuff to put metal together into what we want it to be. Man has developed ways to manipulate metal at his will in a lot faster, more efficient way. But it hasn't always been that way. Matter of fact, in the last 100, let's just be liberal and say the last 150 years, the Industrial Revolution, and when that all started happening, and the landscape of industry changed monumentally, drastically. Think about it. I've thought about this before, digging a hole somewhere, or skidding logs, or loading logs, or something like that. And in the advent of hydraulics, and how that just fundamentally changed our world. Yes. You know, a simple little cylinder with a piston in it and some oil and a pump. And you went from having to dig a hole with a pick and a shovel that might take all day long to coming in there with a backhoe, and you can knock a tree down in 3 minutes. It's on the ground. The root wad's dug out and it's done. Think of what the landscape of our world would look like if hydraulics had been invented 200 years earlier than they were. Just 200 years. I was talking to some people down there in New Madrid yesterday, a farmer from down there, and he said that around the turn of the 1900s, like the beginning of the 1900s, is when they first started clearing west of the Sykeston Ridge, or east of the Sykeston Ridge, they call it down there in New Madrid, and it was all swamps. So they dug canals in there and drained the swamps, and then they started clearing land. And all that fertile river, flat ground down there in the boot heel that they grow stuff in all used to be swamp. And they didn't clear the other side of the ridge until the 50s. And he said that's when they took out the rest of the trees and cleared that side. That's literally only been 70 years ago. And look how much that's changed. I mean, my generation don't even know what that looked like. They don't. All the trees they dug out and harvested from that, they're all gone. Nobody, I mean, who knows where they all went. A lot of houses probably got built with them. But my point is, think about how much that thing changed so much. You know, there's a lot of instruction to be learned from a blacksmith. I mean, we could go with a lot of different trades like I've been talking about here, but I want to just focus on this thing about a blacksmith. A lot to be learned from how he applies his craft, and it can be laid out alongside our lives, and the parallels can yield so much instruction to us in all walks of our life, in all seasons of our life. You know, it's not just something for young parents or for newlyweds or for grandparents or for, you know, new Christians. It's for everybody in all walks of life, in all seasons of life. There's things to be learned in the spiritual world, in the realm of spirituality, and in the physical realm too. So this month I want to talk about four different things. We got four Sundays, so I'm going to talk about four different topics here that deal with a blacksmith and how he does what he does to get the results that he's after successfully, and how we can apply these principles in our own life, in our homes, our marriages, with our kids, with our parents, with our brothers and sisters, with our church family, with our work family. It applies everywhere. And so these are the four things, and then I'm just going to talk about the first one for a little bit. Number one, these things that he must have in order to achieve his goals is this. Number one, the right tools and a good place to work. Very important. Nothing begin without that. And that's just the first little building block. Number two, instruction and guidance. Talk to anybody who does anything with their hands that way, and the one thing they're going to tell you is find someone who knows what they're doing and just learn from them. You're going to make this up on your own. Number three, something it's elemental to what he does. It's fire. You know, it's been manipulated in so many different ways in our lives now as far as working with metal, but a blacksmith had to begin. That's what he started his day out with, was building a fire every day, getting his fire right. Can't do nothing unless your fire's right. Number four, strength. You ever see a picture or an old painting ever of a little skinny blacksmith? No. He's never young. He's usually depicted as a middle-aged to an older gentleman. He's always about this wide across the shoulders, and he's always usually got an arm about that big around with a hammer in it. But all blacksmiths don't start out as big, strong, big fellas like that. But it's part of what he has to have in order to become what he's supposed to be. So this week I want to talk about the first thing I said, the right tools and a good place to work. I know that when we moved in out there where we're at, and I started, you know, I was carving at the time, but it was still evolving into what it has become now, at least to this point. And I had that little old 10 by 16 shed, that little barn building, and I set it between those two trees, and I had my work going on out there, but you know, I didn't put a lot of thought into it. It was more about being visible from the highway and accessible with logs. That was the main thing. I wanted to be able to pull in there and just dump my stuff off right there in front of it and work right there. And I didn't give a lot of thought to the ground until I started working on it. And then every time it rained, all the water washed down through where I worked and washed big ruts in all the sawdust. And it's kind of like at the sawmill. You remember how that, you know, the way the sawmill was laid out for up there on the hill, and everything worked great until it started raining, and then the water would run off the hill across the log yard and right down through the mill. And so you had to work around the little creeks and rivers running through the right through the middle of everything. I mean, your feet were going to get wet if you didn't have good boots, and it was just, you didn't think about that until, oh, now what are we going to do? I still have the same problem at my shop because the way that I wound up building my... It's something people don't give much thought to in their life about where you're building your shop. You know, people meet someone and they fall in love. And then they decide they're going to get married and start a family and start... And they don't give no thought to the groundwork that's needed in order to do this God's way. Even in the matter of what the world calls dating now. I mean, it's totally, no one even talks about it, really. I mean, they don't talk about it anymore. And no thought is given to the fact that, you know, I stand under at my shop now, and that's what I told somebody the other day. I've been standing. It just kind of dawned on me. I got a couple sawhorses that I can move around, but they usually sit in this one spot. And that's what I told somebody the other day. I've been standing right here in this 6 by 6 foot square of space. I've spent the last 4.5 years standing right here. I don't know. It just kind of dawned on me that, you know, if the Lord tarries and I keep doing what I do, I might spend the rest of my life standing right here under this little roof. You know, you don't think about the fact that when you're starting out in life, that this is what it's going to be for, this is where you're going to be forever. You just don't even entertain that thought. Now, if someone brings it to your attention, you might ponder on that and think, yeah, or be enamored with the romantic idea that, oh, it's us forever. But you don't realize that, you know, this could be where we live forever. This life that we have right now could be what it is for us forever. You know, I may move my shop someday because it may get, but nobody gives much thought when they're, I don't want to move my shop. The idea of tearing everything down or moving it around or reorganizing everything is just exhausting to just think about. I don't even want to think about it. I'll try to figure out a way somehow to just endure what is, because it's just too much of a job to move. I established my shop, and now I have to live with what I've established. And if I'd give a little more thought, if I would have turned my shop 90 degrees, right where it sits, but just turned it 90 degrees, it would have changed everything about my shop and about my workspace and about how I do what I do, everything. It would have changed everything, but I didn't do that. I just said, okay, that looks like a good spot right there. And I just went with it. And people set up their marriages that way. People start having kids without thinking about that part of it. People make a decision to do something for the Lord without thinking about that aspect of it. They don't slow down. A good blacksmith will pick out where he's going to put his shop, and he'll put some thought into it. And later on in the month, we'll get into more of this, but there's a whole lot of influence that can be guided in and through him that'll help him with where to put his shop. But this matter of where you set up shop is pivotal. I mean, it can make the difference between success or barely making it and working 10 times as hard as you had to if you'd have just stopped for a second and thought about this before you did it. You could have built right in the same spot, just turned a little different. And it would have made all the difference in the world. You know, I got this big hickory tree that stands right in front of the shop. You've been there and seen, you were there yesterday or day before yesterday, and we all have to, this time of the year, it drops those great big hickory nuts about the size of a golf ball. And they weigh about as much as a golf ball too. And man, oh man, one hit Wyatt the other day. He was down there helping me, and whammo, it fell out of the tree and hit him. One hit me in the back of the neck the other day. I was humped over a log, sawing on a log, and it fell out and hit me right there in the back of the neck. It's just a dangerous time of the year for this tree. Now, in the summertime, it's big and huge, and I work in complete shade. So in the summertime, it's a real blessing. But in the fall, oh my goodness, it's a disaster. And there's hundreds, I dare say thousands, of hickory nuts all over the ground. Wyatt comes down there almost every day and spends an hour a day at least picking up hickory nuts and throwing them in a tub and going and dumping them in the ditch down the hill. Because they'll break your ankles. You know, I looked at one aspect of this tree and thought, that's a good place to put the shop because of the shade. I never even thought about fall and this matter with the hickory nuts. It's literally a serious problem. And someday I'm going to have to take that tree down or move my shop. It's a lot easier to take the tree down than it is to move the shop. I'm just saying. But I never thought about that part of it, see? And, you know, a good place to work, it's usually, I mean, sometimes our circumstances dictate where we're at certain times of our life, and I'm very aware of that. I'm 20 plus years down the road in this game, and my circumstances have changed a lot of times through the years. Everybody here can attest to that, even in your own life. But I'll have to admit that most of the changing came, good or bad, better or worse, it came by my hand. In some way, I influenced whether it got better or whether it got worse. But an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Remember that old saying you heard the old timers say? A lot of truth to that. You know, haste makes waste. You know, if we just learn to slow things down a little bit and not get in a big rush over these things. I mean, what did the Lord say? What did he say? Be still and know that I am God. He didn't say, go out here and jump right in the fray and I'll let you know what I want you to do. No, he said, be still and know. When David needed to get a hold of the Lord, he went somewhere quiet. When Jesus needed to get something from his Father, he went somewhere by himself and got in the quiet. Stopped. And our lives, everything in our world, what is the world trying to be? They just keep you busy more and more and more. I mean, look at our circumstances this week and just with everything that happens in the fall. I mean, good night. There ain't a day free for nothing. It's my favorite time of the year because the weather changes and the leaves change and it's just like a burden lifted off. And yet there's this gray cloud that kind of sort of goes along with it because of the, well, we're just going to be working till New Year's. And there's just going to be so much going on. It makes me sad in a way that it's like it takes away from the fall and the harvest time, what that's supposed to be. We do that to our lives in a lot of ways. We orchestrate our lives and do things so that we paint ourselves into a corner in this matter. And then, you know, like with my shop, I keep talking about that, but it's just part of what's on my mind and it's something to compare it to that I can relate to. But, you know, what am I going to do now? When it rains, the shop, it runs water down through everything. And I got this hickory tree trying to kill me every time I step out from under the roof. And if I'm not wearing earplugs, it scares the daylights out of me every time one of them big hickory nuts hits that metal roof. Bam! And just makes me jump out of my skin and I have to wear earplugs all day long just to keep from being scared by the noise that they make. What am I going to do? Well, there's things I can do. I mean, look, I could have put the shop in a different place and the tree would have survived and the shop would have survived. That's not an option now. So I can do things to help myself in that matter. But I'm saying when you're starting out in life, you know, all the instruction is there from the Lord to help you. He puts people in your life and he puts people in your circle of influence that can help you because they've put their shop in the wrong place a lot of times. They've had to work in unpleasant circumstances. A good blacksmith don't pick a hillside with a hickory tree over the top of him to build his shop on. He don't do that. He'll look around and he'll find a good, solid, flat piece of ground that the water don't run through. Might have some rock underneath it. Good, solid place. Place, he don't build it in a sawdust pile where first spark comes along, catches the place on fire and burns everything to the ground. He don't do that. And, you know, it's something that deserves a lot of attention and thought to all of us. You know, it's, you know, if I had to, how many times have you heard somebody say, boy, if I could go back to when I was 17 or 18 and know what I know now, would you do something different? Well, of course, we'd all do everything different. If you knew what you know now and you could go back to 18-year-old me, man, yeah, I'd make a lot of choices different, including how I built that shop down there below my house. But all is not lost because you can't go back. There's only from here on, and you can make it work. But when you're starting out like you guys, man, give it some thought. Have some patience. Pick the right spot for your shop. And then your tools. Here's something that he won't do. He won't buy his tools from China. He don't buy his blacksmithing tools from Harbor Freight. He don't do that. Now, I buy tools from Harbor Freight sometimes, but it's usually sanding pads and things like that that get used and thrown away. And every once in a while, you'll get something good from there. But man, A blacksmith's livelihood depends on the dependability of his tools. You know, he rears back with a 4-pound hammer and hits that anvil one time when it's cold and it's made out of pot metal and the horn breaks off of the thing. What's he going to do? Well, he's going to starve because he can't make a living. Zach, one of the things he likes to do is find old blacksmith tools and he collects them. And it's really neat because they made a lot of their own tools because they could decide what kind of steel they used for their tongs and things like that. And he has a pair of tongs that it was like his great-great-grandpa or great-great-great-grandpa was a blacksmith way, way back then. And they've been passed down through the years. And, you know, he showed them to me one time. And, you know, he's used them to make things with because they still work, man. They still are very functional, and they're 100-plus years old. You know, he didn't go get it down at the Weesacket somewhere. I mean, he made them out of something that was built to last. There's a guy over there now that's what he does. A lot of the farriers in that area, they all have stuff made by this guy. And Super T Forge, and he don't make horseshoes. He makes tools for horseshoers, but they are top notch, man. I mean, high, you know, first class. They're not cheap. Good tools aren't cheap. And you don't find them at the sale barn. You don't. He don't get them. He don't buy cheap stuff. He don't have cheap things to work with. And it's that way with us too. There's a lot of cheap tools that's being offered to kids, young married couples, young parents, old folks. There's a lot of cheap stuff being offered to them to use to build things with them in their life. I don't use pulling chainsaws. I don't do that. I made a joke about it the other day. I said, those are yard sale chainsaws. Well, they are. I mean, I've had a pulling chainsaw before and I could cut up wood with it, but sometimes if it's dark. But, you know, when you go out there every day, and you have to know that on that third or fourth tug on that rope, that thing's going to start and it'll run all day and not let you down. You got to have something that costs a little more than a yard sale chainsaw or a hammer that's not made out of good stuff. Little things like, for example, and I mean, I'm running out of time here, but when Zach started doing his horseshoeing and stuff, he had some tools that he bought. They were good tools. But even that one tool, he had a hammer. It's his hammer that he uses constantly, that 2-pound hammer for shape and everything on that anvil. And you got to see his hands. Now, he's been doing it for 15 years now, I guess, or something close to that. And his hands just look like catcher's mitts. They're they're just like leather. But something that a good blacksmith will tell you is that don't ever put polyurethane or paint on the handle of your hammer. Sand it off of there and oil it down. Because if you oil your handle and your hammer, the oil from your hands will absorb into it. And it's like your hammer and your hand become one. And that handle won't rub blisters on your hand. But if it's a polyurethane or a painted surface like that that won't absorb your oils out of your hand, it'll rub a blister on your hand right now. And that makes sense. Old timers used to oil the handles on their shovels and stuff. I remember Grandpa doing that on some of his stuff. But, you know, it's just simple things like that that you and I wouldn't think about. But it's pivotal of whether or not he's able to do his job and do it like he needs to do. A good place to work and the right kind of tools. You know, don't go out here and go the cheap route when you're looking for tools to work with for your whole life. I mean, I was talking about here a while back about finding them old broad axes and these old crosscut saws and old sickles and scythes and stuff that they used to make by hand, and then they would pass them down through their generations. They'd last that long because they took such good care of them, but they were also built out of quality stuff. They lasted. You didn't hone your broad axe with a file. You did it on a stone because it didn't take away as much metal. And you could put a better edge on it. And it would hold an edge longer. Well, why? Well, because it had to last. come at a great cost. You talked about Grandpa finding that old broad axe in the woods that time. And we commented on how that, you know, what a sad day that must have been for that guy. I wonder if he went back and looked for it. I wonder how long he stood out there and looked for it and didn't find it. That was a big expense. That was a bad deal for him because come at such a price. Don't take and get your tools from to work in your life with. Get the ones that are going to last a lifetime. They're right here in God's Word. They can be found if you go to the right places. And they'll cost. They're going to cost you something. But it's worth it. In the end, you're going to make that back. And tenfold. But if you use cheap tools, you're just going to spend your money on more cheap tools. And you ain't going to get anything done. You're going to mess around and be in trouble. And not have anything to show for it. Same way with where you work. Man, I could talk about this for a whole nother hour. There's a lot, you know, just think about this. This is some food for thought about where you're working and what you're working with. It matters. It's the most, you can't even begin. You can't get your start unless you got a good place to work and you got some good tools to work with, you know. Anybody that does anything with their hands, they know that. They, you know, even like you working with your leather and stuff, there's things that are worth having, and then there's things that are, they're boat anchors. They're not good for anything. I mean, they look like the right kind of tool, but they just don't work. And so think about that.